Hi, folks. In all, we have a principle. Let's live one day at a time. Tomorrow is gone. Today is here. The future is not yet with us. And in that trite little statement, there is a great deal of wisdom. But like so many of our familiar cliches, it doesn't cover all the territory and can still leave us rather cockeyed on the subject of time. I make these few observations as a backdrop on talking a little about the traditions. For example, clearly, if a person is all the time in the past, whether with guilt, whether with remorse, or wishing for the good old days when he could drink like a gentleman, no progress at all is possible. And at best, he becomes a conservative who is against all change. On the other hand, if I live in today, in a really absolute sense, and forget about yesterday, and think nothing about tomorrow, I become a creature of pure expediency. And you get nowhere. On the contrary, if I'm always pondering the future, I'm out of the reality of today. So, that if you make these two fair divisions of time and label this one as good, the present, and the past is rather bad, and the future is not something to be concerned with, I think we're out of balance. Actually, time is a stream of consciousness. And we came on it out of the past, through today, and we go out into the future. Now then, what bearing does this have on the AA tradition? You know, at times we're apt to congratulate ourselves upon those traditions, as though it were a list of our collective virtues about which we wish to brag. We say, oh yes, we put the common welfare first. Oh yes, we're a pure democracy. Oh, yes, we have no punishments, no rules, no regulations, a beautiful benign anarchy in that sense. And we don't get complicated with endorsements or alliances. And we keep ourselves as collectively poor as possible so as to not get messed up with dough, filthy lucre. And we have no professional class. You know, plumbers can do as well as anybody with AA, only to the truth. We just don't need that. And so on. We go through this list as though we were reciting a list of virtues, very singular to us. Well, I submit that's a rather dangerous and childish thing. Actually, these 12 traditions, which are before me here, are in reality a codification of the lessons of past experience that we got out of the school of damned hard knocks in the early days of AA, and which we continue to get. These are the lessons of experience. This list of hopeful do's and don'ts. Now then, I think about the origins of some of these traditions. I believe the theme of our upcoming conference is really the common welfare comes first. Without AA unity, there can be no recovery. That's a frank recognition of the fifth point. But as you look at the traditions, one after another, you see that all of them are directly or indirectly related to this subject of the common welfare. And you see this idea in great strength in this last tradition. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Ever remind us to place principles before personalities. Well, that, I think, is a spiritual statement of the idea of the common welfare. Take tradition two. In the early days of AA, we weren't placing principles ahead of personalities all the time. There wasn't any such thing as a group conscience. Dr. Bob and I were school teachers at Clark. And as our leadership was gained in strength, we began to think very well of ourselves. And it was a very long time before we realized that those in position of leadership are biased by consideration of power, prestige, money, and the like. That's how we started off. But the time came little by little, and through many bitter experiences, and I've undergone some, and Bob has, or any old-timer has. The good conscience began to say to us, the common welfare comes first. We do not have these biases. Let us take thoughts of the general welfare, and after that, let's see where the leadership stands. So we turn up as leaders who have not power in the usual sense, not prestige in the usual sense. We turn up as genuine servants with a discretion from the group conscience to act for them. And that's our faith here. The general welfare comes first. Take another which may at first glance seem a little remote. At about year two of the Akron group, a poor devil came to Dr. Baum in a grievous state. He could qualify as an alcoholic all right. And then he said, Dr. Baum, I've got a real problem to pose you. I don't know if I could join AA because I'm sex deviant. Well, that had to go out to the group conscience, you know. Up to then, it was supposed that any society could say who was going to join it. And pretty soon, the group conscience began to seethe and boil, and it boiled over. And under no circumstances could we have such a power and such a disgrace among us, said the gentleman. And you know, right then our destiny hung on a razor edge over this single case. In other words, would there be rules that could exclude so-called undesirability? And that caused us in that time, and for quite a time, respecting this single case, to ponder what is the more important, the reputation that we shall have, what people shall think, or is it our character? And who are we considering our record? Alcoholism is quite as unlovely. Who are we to deny a man his opportunity, any man or woman? And finally, the day of resolution came. And a bunch were sitting in Dr. Bob's living room arguing what to do. Whereupon, dear old Bob looked around and blandly said, isn't it time, folks, to ask ourselves, what would the master do in a situation like this? Would he turn this man away? And that was the beginning of the age tradition that any man who has a drinking problem is a member of AA if he says so, not whether we say so. Now, I think that the import of this on the common welfare has already been said, because it takes in even more territory than the confines of our fellowship. It takes in the whole world of alcohol. Their charter, the freedom to join AA, is assured. Indeed, it was an act in the general welfare. Then we got into, very naturally, into this question of how we were going to relate ourselves to other people in the field of endeavor. How are we going to relate ourselves to the public at large? And again, the same question. The public welfare, or the AA welfare, the general welfare. And we came up with the view that we had better stick to our lesson. We could offer our principles to the whole world and offer the whole world everything but AA's name, which we would like to have stand for first principles. And this, you see, has served the general welfare. Now, there were a terrific amount of deviations, you see, all this time. Letters were pouring in after the Saturday Post piece into the office. And naturally, we were getting married through the microphone, through both an anonymity, to all sorts of enterprises, some good, some bad, some indifferent. So the lesson was born in. We are not criticizing endorsements in society around us, but we dare not give it. Not that we're afraid, this is sense of truth. It's good sense, and we've already seen what happens when we start to do this. And so it goes down to this whole list of tradition. In the early days, in public relations, the AA thought, well, I'll get myself on the radio. I got connections. I'll get my name and picture in the paper, like what everybody else does. But after a few had fallen on their faces after doing this, we began to see that it wasn't for us. So, as I've said, our tradition is a list of the lessons of yesterday. So that as you read the traditions with a sense of history and information about it, you will relive our past, and you will see how we have brought forth from the past on its time stream the lessons thereof, and have tried to make estimates about the future. We are not absolutely fixed in all of our principles. There is room to change. On the other hand, we shall not lightly cast away the hard-earned principles which bear on our unity, on our survival, on our growth under God's grace. As Herb left us, I think that we step out of one epoch into another. During his tenure, the last basic modification was made in our structure, the ratio change. in which we assume full responsibility as a fact for the conduct of our world affairs. This, perhaps, was the last great change in basis. And as I remarked this afternoon, or this afternoon session, I made the remark that now it is a question of preserving what we have, of improving its function. You can always improve its function. But I don't think I nailed that proposition down. I think I made it seem as though everything was going to be clear sailing from here out. And when Tommy Breen got up to keynote this thing, he had a keynoter now, you know, probably well ever after. I'm going to lose my job, I can see that. Anyway, Tom got up and he said, it's all very well that we have the steps. It's very well that we have the tradition. It's very well that our functional structure seems adequate. But let us be bigger. The problem and the difficulty of the future can actually be greater than those we have already survived. Let's not be pessimistic, but let's be realistic. This, in effect, was what he said. And after all, we are living in a most dangerous world. We are surrounded by behavior the exact opposite of that by which we must conform to survive. In other words, minorities are able to say, we are the most important. The general welfare has to wait upon us. And the world is going through these same cycles on what apparently, from a poor alcoholic's point of view, is one hell of a dry bend. A very, very dangerous. So that life may, in the next 10 or 20 years, be a very dangerous one for each of us. It may be dangerous for our whole society. Certainly we have little appearance of religious skit. But let us never underestimate the vast forces which are tearing the world apart. Have you ever sat down and seriously thought what we'd do if we were driven underground? Have you ever seriously thought how we would be affected by firing squads? These are common episodes. Don't suppose I'm pessimistic, I'm hopeful. Now, vigil is going to be the price that we pay for unity. And the love among us and for each other, that indeed, everything considered, passes all understanding. These are the things that under God's grace, I am certain, will sustain us through all calamities, no matter how formidable.
Down after all of this. Gilbert.
Well, I like the informal, pleasant type of approach. It seemed to me that on occasion like this, questions are something of infinitely more value than a lecture or a story. But Rip suggested that I make some remarks here tonight, and I'm only too glad to do that. And coming down on the plane, I got speculating with myself about the early days of the AA and about the meaning of them in terms of the grace of God. I've read somewhere that if a grain of wheat, which has been stored for centuries in a dry place, is exposed to the right soil and the right climate and to enough light from above, it will manifest life and it will unfold and it will grow. But this presupposes the right soil, the right climate, and above all, enough love. Well, I think it's that way with AA. I remember years back when we first began to get publicity, and the first very large occasion was a feature piece done in the Saturday Evening Post, which all at once produced us about 6,000 members. This was in 1941, and by then, a number of medics had become close friends, some of them psychiatrists. And these fellows allowed their names to be used, a rather audacious step in those days, I assure you. Their names were used in a Post article. I make this point because one later asked to testify on another occasion, they refused to do it. And these were the circumstances. The first gal that got sober in AA is one known to many of you as Marty. Still very much of a growing concern in the education field. Marty was a most difficult case. God knows we're all complex, but Marty was really a champ. And she had been under the care of a Dr. Foster Kennedy, a man of very wide repute in that time, worldwide renowned, a neurologist. And he watched Marty as she was planted in the new soil. He watched her receive this life. Well, he was tremendously impressed. He came to some meetings, and soon he said to me, "Bill, would it be possible to have two or three of the psychiatrists in institutions who have seen recovery, the very grim cases, people that you say are friends of yours and who have testified for you in the Post piece, couldn't we get a group of this sort to come to the Academy of Medicine and explain what they have seen?" Well, we thought this was just great, because in those days there were a few friends indeed. So showing by these people, by reason of Dr. Kennedy, well, what's to be done? So one by one, we went to them. And we said, "Will they come to the Academy?" And we supposed they would. After all, some of the Kennedy glories would brush off them. You know they were friends anyhow, and they proved it, so why not? And Martha one would do it. And when pressed for their reasons for not doing it, each one of them separately said the same thing. In effect, each said, look, Bill, you folks have added up in one column more of the resources which have been separately applied to alcoholics than anyone else. For example, you have this kinship in suffering. You have possibilities of communication that others don't have. You have a crude form of self-examination or analysis and of catharsis. You have a great new outgoing interest. You reduce guilt by restitution. And you have this great compelling interest in helping others. And then there is the religious factor. And then there is this factor of the hopelessness. So far as the resources of the individual are concerned, of the knowledge. Now, this is a formidable list of forces. But we still can't come to the academy. Well, why not? Well, said they, we see in AA sometimes in weeks, in a few months, shifts in motivation that even the sum of these forces couldn't begin to account for, because we all too well understand the difficulties of this compulsion, this subtle compulsion. And the sum of them won't add up to the speed of these transformations in these very grim cases. So for us, there is an unknown factor at work in AA. And among ourselves, being scientists, we call it the X factor. We believe you people call it the grace of God. And who shall go to the academy to explain the grace of God to God's Father? No one can. And we simply aren't wrong. So, I think it is just as futile as ever for any of us to presume to explain this matter of grace around which our entire galaxy of principles and activities gathers and clusters. We can't do that, but we can examine this matter of the soul and this matter of fun. And this matter of illumination, which for some reason or other, we have made ourselves with. Clearly, God's grace is in into all. So it might be said, why haven't alcoholics sobered many times more often through grace in the head? It's available. Why has religion been more successful, numerically at least? Why has medicine been more successful? How is it that laymen seem to be doing this thing? So I would like to tell a story depicting, at least as it seems to me, what the style is, what the climate is, and what the light is. These things of which we have been placed in such treasured possession. There is no doubt that in an ordinary sense of time, A began in the office of a psychiatrist. And we might be mindful of this when we criticize people in this profession. Of course, for most of us, the origin is 2,000 years old. For some of us, perhaps older. But I'm speaking of the situation in an immediate sense. How was it precipitated, this thing? This, too, is a matter of conjecture. But here's how it seems to me. There was a certain businessman of great attainment. He's cut down by the grog. He runs the gamut of treatments in this country. And this would be in the year about 1932, when he was just about at the end of his tether. So he went abroad and became a patient of Dr. Carl Jung. And as all of you know, Jung was one of the founding fathers of the art, I prefer that instead of science, of psychiatry. And Jung, Adler, Freud, were the three founding fathers. But of these, only Jung seemed to think that man is something more than $2 worth of chemicals, a bundle of instincts, and an uncertain intellect. Jung said, man has something beyond this. That man has soul. So, our traveler had found a truly great human being. Great indeed, as events fell out. He placed himself under that dear man's tutelage for a whole year, becoming more and more confident that the hidden springs of this baleful compulsion to drink were being understood and removed and chanced away. He began to feel more free. There was no drinking while he was under treatment. At the end of the year, he left Carl Jung, and in 1 month, he was tight. And the bender was terrific. So, in infinite despair, he came back to Carl Jung and said, is there anything now for me? You were my course of last resort. And this great man said, Roland, I thought for a time after you first came that you might be one of those rare cases in which my art has been helpful. Otherwise, I should not have encouraged you instead. But alas, I'm obliged to conclude that you are not. And that there is nothing that I have to offer you. My art has failed you. I need not say that coming from a man of his eminence, this one statement, how beautiful to know it. And the whole destiny of AA, you and me, and always, has spent tongue on that sentence. So then has it found that agony was added to despair. And he cried out, "But is there nothing else?" And this was the answer he got. Rolling time out of mind, alcoholics have recovered here and there, now and then, through religious experience. Spiritual experiences, let us say, or very truly true conversion. A naughty word for us, eh? We don't use it for obvious reasons. But, said the doctor, this benign lightning seldom strikes. And no one can say where or when it will, or for the resuscitation of food. So I simply would advise you to place yourself in a religious atmosphere, remembering the hopelessness of your doing anything about it on your own remaining resources alone, and cooperating with your associates and casting yourself upon whatever God their name is. So Roland aligned himself with the Oxford groups of that time, a rather evangelical movement, rather aggressive, very easy it is to criticize. It was non-denominational, however, and it used simple common denominators of religion, simple moral principles. It called upon its members to admit that they could not solve the life problem on their own. It called upon them for self-examination. It called upon them for restitution. It called upon them for a kind of giving in the Franciscan manner, the kind of giving that demands no return in money, power, prestige, and the like. The losing of oneself in life of others. Such was the nature of the crowd with which he became associated. Unaccountably to him, the obsession to drink left. And for some years, he had no more trouble. At the time in the groups, there were a few alcoholics sober. There's one now at Ann Arbor that goes back to that time. An old friend who never became an AA. Sobered up in the Austin group. So Roland returned to America, and the groups here in those days were headed by an Episcopal clergyman called Sam Shoemaker. And in his congregation and among the groups were two or three other alcoholics that were renounced for insane God. And Hazard had a summer place near Bennington, Vermont. And two friends, one of them son of a local judge, and himself an alcoholic, described the plight of a boy who was a school time chum of mine, Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie had been deteriorating horribly. There were summer folks in the town above Manchester. Ebbie had run his car into the side of the farmer's house, pushed the wall of the kitchen in. The door would still be open to the car. Ebbie stuck his head out, and to the poor woman cowering in the corner who hadn't been hit, he said, "Hey, what about a cup of coffee?" Well, the town fathers had panicked. They were going to commit Ebbie for alcoholic insanity. So the judge's son and Hazard picked up the man who was to become my sponsor. Meanwhile, I had gone the route with which you're all familiar. I had sobered up the summer before, scared to death by the verdict of my doctor, Dr. Silkwood. The one we had since named the little doctor who loved drunks, and he must have been because in his lifetime he dealt with some 40,000 of them. As a hack doctor in a drying out place. And he had an idea that this thing was an illness, having several components, a spiritual illness, a moral illness, and also a physical illness. And perhaps oversimplifying, he was apt to describe an alcoholic as a person condemned by a compulsion to drink against his own interest, to drink in spite of his perfect willingness to stop, and that this drinking was coupled to an increasing sensitivity of the body, which, if the drinking went on, guaranteed his insanity and one day his death. So this sort of a sentence had been spoken to Lois at long last by my doctor, Dr. Silkwood. So, you see, the saw was under preparation. We were beginning to learn a little more about science. Ebbie and my other friend Roland had received a considerable amount of light. Well, I got drunk in about 2 months, even in spite of the sentence that I would have to be locked up or go nuts, maybe within a year. And then my friend Ebbie, who had been brought to New York from Vermont, who had unaccountably sobered up for the time being in the action group, came to visit me. But I, too, was in great despair. Despair is a primary ingredient, indeed, of this thought. In the medical jargon, we might call it deflation of death. Some deflation, huh? So, Ebbie came to see me. And he pitched at me this list of moral, you might say, cliche. Nothing so new about that. I was in favor of honesty. I was in favor of helping other people. I was in favor of practically everything he had to say, except one thing. I was not in favor of God. For I had received one of those magnificent modern schooling, scientific schooling, that assured me that by a series of stages, picking up implements from somewhere, as they went along, I could be traced back to a single piece of ooze in prehistoric seas. And this was my faith. And science was my God. So along comes Abbott. And along comes Hume, for whom I had respect. And here was my reaction. Science can't do it. Medicine can't do it. Psychology can't do it. Religion, sometimes. That was his thought. But how could I buy a religion? So I felt trapped. In other words, I was gripped in the trap which we every day construct for the drunk who approaches us, saying, well, I think the group wise must be great, helping other people on board, but I couldn't get the spiritual angle as I did. Now, as you know, this gentleman is a newcomer, like me, is being caught in this trap. When you and I talk to another alcoholic, and we identify ourselves as having been denizens of this strange world, and having emerged, and we describe this malady in the terms of our God science, and that God pronounces the sense of hopelessness on us, the sentence. We are deflated at best. And then we learn that now we have accepted our personal hopelessness. There still isn't any hope because we cannot go to the Godhead. And this was the awful villain into which I was cast by my friend Abbott, bringing on the one side all of the sad news, but on the other side, the spectacle of his own relief. And that was the word he used. He couldn't say he was on the waterway. The obsession had just left him. As soon as he became worse, trust on the basis of these principles. And indeed, as he became willing to appeal to whatever God there might be, and this was reducing the theological requirements an awful lot. Well, I went on drinking about 3 weeks, and in no waking hour could I forget the face of my friend as text for release as I looked out through a haze of gin into his face as he pitched the synthesis at me. A conversion experience is not for me. I'm an obstinate Vermonter. Besides, I can't pass. People say to me, have faith. And I believe I'd have faith if I could have it, but I can't. But anyhow, I'll go and get dried up. So I went to the hospital. I must have had a little optimism because I came in with a bag of beer. I tried to share it on the subway up. I was waving a bottle. Dr. Silkworth came out, and I yelled at him, "This time, Doc, I got it." He said, "I'm afraid you had, Bill. You better get upstairs and go to bed." And he looked very sad. For he loved me. So I went upstairs and went to bed. I was there well ahead of the D-teams. So in about 3 days, I was all in the clear. But the more sober I got, the more awful the despair, the depression. So I think it was the morning of the third and fourth day that my friend Abby showed up in the doorway. And my feeling was ambivalent at once. So I said, "Well, this is the time he's going to pour on the evangelist." And on the other hand, I was saying, "Well, he should be looking for a job. Why is he up there at 11 o'clock in the morning to see me? He does practice what he preaches." So, Abby knew my prejudices. So he waited for me to ask him again for that neat little formula through which he had achieved relief. And dutifully he went through it. You got on it yourself with another person in confidence. You made restitution. You helped others. And you prayed to God as you understood it. I think he might have even used that phrase. And without much more ado, he was gone. No question. And again, I couldn't have touched the concert. And again, the despair deepened. Until the last of this frightful obstinacy, momentarily, was apparently crushed out. And then, like a child crying out in the dark, I said, "If there is a Father, if there is a God, will he show himself?" And the place lit up in a great glare. A wondrous white light. And then I began to have images in the mind's eye, so to speak. And one came in which I seemed to see myself standing on a mountain. And a great clean wind was blowing. And this blowing at first went around, and then it seemed to go through. And then the ecstasy redoubled, and I found myself exclaiming, "I am a free man. So this is the God of the creatures." And little by little, the ecstasy subsided, and I found myself in a new world of consciousness. And one of the early reflections in this world of great peace that stole over me was that all is well with God. I am a part of his cosmos at play. Even evil, the naysayers, can be transmitted into good. So I have been declared as death by a fellow suffering. to use the scientific verdicts to debate me, who used his ability to communicate to me through our kinship of common suffering, and who made the example of a person who fights for the truth. Show them to me, hear in me, wise the thought, hear wise the son, and God knows the life is great. Now, I venture this assertion with confidence of A.A. as a spiritual awakening or experience of exactly this stuff. Certainly it is not for me to differ with theologians, but let me say I prefer to think that there is no essential difference between what happened to me and what happened to each sound AA, excepting the time on. Going back to those psychiatrists who said we can understand this tremendous shift in motivation despite all your resources. Well, in my case, the shift, but the fruits have been the same. And one of the most terrible compulsions and obsessions known has been expelled from us almost wholesale through this happy sense of medicine, religion, and our own experience in suffering in the public and sharing the grace of this one with the next. So far, there's my speech. Somebody gets up, and this happens time after time, and he says, now, folks, I ain't got the spiritual angle yet. I'm making the group my higher power. They're trouble, and I wasn't. So I got a higher power, but I ain't got the spiritual angle the way you fellas did. And as for Bill's thing, well, he looked sane in other respects, but, you know. Now, this guy will get up there and tell a story of losing this compulsion and of it being cleared out of them and it being motivated in many other ways, just like those psychiatrists said, in a matter of months or 6 months or a year. Now, just take one of those fellows and try to imagine all of those shifts in motivation taking place within 6 months, or within 6 minutes instead of 6 months. I think, had this happened to that fellow, he too would have had ecstasy. So I think it's a time element. I personally see no great advantage in these tremendous experiences, save in my case only one. It did give me an instant conviction of the presence of God, which has never left me from that moment. in spite of the worst I can do, and it's often been damn bad. And no matter what pressure, I feel that that extradition may have made the difference whether I would have persisted with AA in the early years or not. Actually, it has some liabilities, and I've seen it in others who have had these experiences in AA, and that's quite a lot. And this is a tendency, and I think you feel love, give us some excuse for it too, are beginning to think that because we have these tremendous illumination, that we are something special. So you begin to develop a kind of a paranoia alongside of a perfectly valid experience. And this is just what happened to me. I damn near botched up the whole one by coming out of this, working furiously with John. And before anybody had been sobered up, I got so far off base as to loudly declare one time to an audience by no means spellbound that I was going to sober up all the goddamn drunks in the world. Now that is still paranoia, if you will. So don't long for the illumination. I think you have to have the experience that's appropriate.
Well, I'm not lying
for you. Well, some people do, you know. Oh, my God, if I only have one line to dwell. Now, actually, this is maybe said very sincerely because this may be guys slipping around. But he may be slipping around on account of the fact that he's a little spooky and needs someone in vitamin B3, so now we're put on Hawking.